Voices of VR Podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR Podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my series of looking at different immersive stories from Venice Immersive 2024, today's episode we're looking at a piece called Project Lost Worlds, which is by Fens. It's a VR chat world that is a part of the competition. So I had a conversation with Fens last year around his Complex 7, and he's just a real master world builder and able to create these really vast scenes with amazing lighting. And this year is probably one of the most ambitious projects that he's had yet, where you're taking this kind of interstellar space cruise into another world where there's all these like dinosaurs that you get to explore and look at. And it's such a large project that this is actually just a kind of an early demo. He says it's probably around 30 or 40% of what it's going to be when it's completely finished. And so even though it was being shown within the competition here this year at Venice Immersive, he's not going to be having a public launch until sometime in 2025. So we get a little bit of an early look and explore through some of his imaginal interstellar space tourism, space safari, and all the different inspirations from like Interstellar to like Avatar, as well as like Jurassic Park. So all these things fuse together within the context of this piece. So that's what we're coming on today's episode of the Voices of VR Podcast. So this interview with Fens happened on Sunday, September 1st, 2024. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Hello, I am Fens, and I'm a world builder and a 3D artist at VRChat.
All right, so why don't you go ahead and give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into working with VR?
Yeah, so I started out as a concept artist, 2D illustrator, and I do illustration for like probably 5 to 6 years, and then I do concept art for like about 3 years. Before VRChat, I do concept art for video games, movies. If they need like a piece of, you know, conceptualized art or story or something, I will draw it for them and they turn it into like a 3D model. But then about 5.5 years ago, almost 6 years ago, I saw a video on on YouTube about VRChat. I got curious, downloaded the thing, and made my first world about 6 or 7 months later after getting a little acquainted with the platform. And ever since then, blink of an eye, 6 years later, I am now working at VRChat as a 3D artist and also been making various experiences in world as my personal piece.
Right. Well, 5 or 6 years ago put us into like, you know, 2018, 2019 of the Knuckles era. Was it the Knuckles meme that got you into VRChat, or was it something else? What was it that you saw on YouTube?
It was something else, but it was definitely because of the Knuckles that those... It was Jemski. His series of the whatever that called Only in VRChat or something like that. And I saw some clip about it and people were having fun doing like sandbox. But then when I looked closer into it, I realized, oh wait, those are user created worlds and avatars. And that has been my things for the like most of my younger life, where I just love making custom map, playing The Sims, doing, you know, tycoon games, or even doing like custom StarCraft maps and whatnot. And the fact that you can do this with multiplayer online in real time was crazy to me, so I just jumped in.
Well, I know that usually you are, most people go into VRChat and experience other things, and eventually you start to build your own worlds. But what kind of communities or other worlds did you see that then convinced you that you wanted to actually start to dive in and start to build? Was it pretty soon, or did you kind of check things out, or maybe describe a little about your early days of VRChat?
I was pretty shy at first, a little introvert, so a lot of the time I just kind of like go around public world and see what other people are doing and just kind of like be the background and hopefully maybe can get a small conversation or two. But the more I check out the worlds, the more I was inspired to do it. Particularly in the early days, there was one of Science Laser world called Archery. And there was a little flyer on the ground to say, hey, build your own world and whatnot. I don't remember the exact message, but it was something I was like, okay, right, it's time for me to like stop putting this off. And I shouldn't like seriously put some time into trying this out, finally.
Well, being a concept artist, was most of your medium and output in 2D, or were you working with 3D modeling at all? Or maybe talk about the existing media that you were doing, your practice of concept art, and then, you know, slowly getting into more and more of the 3D and world building parts.
So as concept artists, we are trained to utilize you know, the best way to get to the end result, even if that includes 3D. So yes, 3D was involved, but not to the extent that was my work creation that I do nowadays. You can go into Blender and you put some cube together, and maybe you put on a rough shape or whatever you want to draw, and then you paint over it. And that we get you the result faster without having to, you know, recalculate like the horizon line or the perspective and everything. So 3D was a central part, but it was not the deep, you know, world building that I am currently doing as a 3D artist.
So then what was the first world that you created?
It was called Shark Fin Cafe. Goes by my name Finn back then, and I love all things sharks. One of the things I saw on Reddit, I think it was Reddit, people were asking like, hey, anybody knows like a rain world? You can like just sit and relax in and watch the rain just, you know, dropping down. And I was like, whoa, this actually didn't exist at the time. So I made the cafe. I converted one of the shaders from shadertoy.com that had like the window rain dripping affecting. That was the first ever done on VRChat. I am positive because I never saw that at the time. So I put it on the window, and then people was like, oh wow, like this cafe is so cozy, and people come by and even just sit there and watch the rain. And now you got all the home world with like all the rainy shader thing. So it was pretty cool.
Yeah, there's a lot of worlds, a lot of public worlds where I go into, and that there's raining sounds outside and people hanging out. So it's definitely become a bit of a meme in the public worlds. So as a concept artist, you're usually working with clients or other like people who have very specific visions for what they want. And so then you come into VRChat, you build your first world. Then what was the process of like getting feedback, having people see it, and you know, what happened from there?
So what is the thing, I think we'll say advantage. So when working as a concept artist, obviously you have to look at the source material or whatever the idea to have, and then transform that into a 2D pictures. And then hopefully that aligns with the vision. If not, then you have the revisions. But for my own stuff, I kind of have it on my head already. And for me, I kind of usually can skip the part where I do have to draw it out. But able to have the skill previously working as a 2D artist and as a concept artist to understand like where that process in the development is, and I can plan ahead with my own personal project without having to do the thing to begin with, which is something I found actually a lot of people have trouble with. Like they have a general idea, but they don't understand like the picture or the vision for it, and they don't really know how to execute it. And for me, that's my little advantage of being a 2D and concept artist, is that I am able to mostly execute what I have in my mind by using my previous experience as a concept artist.
Okay, and so does that mean you don't make any sketches when you do it? You just go straight into your 3D modeling program and make it out and put it into VR? Or like, is there any sort of like planning or sketching?
Sometimes there is some. I do actually have concept art for some of my work. It's private. I haven't really released any of them where I need to really have a concrete, because sometimes you have a picture in your mind and it does distort over time, or it does change. And if you want to hold down like a very core idea, you probably want to do like they call it like hero art, basically. So you wouldn't keep essentially the color palette, the theme, the vibe, the lighting and whatnot, and hopefully that you can use that as a reference for the rest of the development phase. But for me, as far as like concepting, it would be mostly in the form of they call white boxing. It's basically you just put down a bunch of like white box, and then you fill that over with like actual asset, and then build the environment over time, which is kind of almost like the concept art in the early part, but instead of painting over it, now you actually put in 3D asset over it.
And do you add any texturing to these white boxes, or is it just literally like cubes in space just to get a sense of the overall spatial architecture of a space?
A lot of time they are texture on, but well, texture would probably be a bit far. They are colored, and then I would make the lighting on them, and then they would get the actual asset feeling.
Okay, yeah, so you're working a lot with lighting. Well, I know last year we were talking about the experience that you had Complex 7, and you were doing a lot more advanced like lighting techniques and kind of trickery in a way that you would create these impossible lights, but just to give it a little bit more pop in these virtual worlds. But if you think about from Complex 7 and your latest, your Project Lost Worlds, which is showing this year at Venice Immersive 2024, you've had a number of different worlds you've created between your first world, and then how many worlds have you put out since your very first world?
I would say probably 30 to 40, way more in private, but publicly about 35 or so.
Roughly how many private then?
70.
Like total 70 more additional or just?
Yeah, 70 more additional.
Okay, so about 30% of all the stuff you've created is only public, and 70 or so percent of it is private.
Yes.
Okay. Wow. Okay. So, and is that just because you're sketching for yourself, or are there other clients, or is it just your own creative process of messing around with stuff and seeing how it looks without having other people look at it yet?
I have an extremely strict public standard. When I release something, it had to be polished. I have a reason why it exists. And for a lot of my private world, it's either a tech demo or a test lighting or a scene, or even like a whole world where it's functional, but it doesn't have a purpose, or I wouldn't quote unquote call it like public ready. Yes, which means like testing all the bug, getting like UI and QA and like everything work, like there's nothing wrong if public people come in. So when those things doesn't meet that standard, I don't release them regardless of how far they are.
Okay, so about 100 worlds that you've been making for the past 5 or 6 years. So that's, you know, anywhere from 20 or less a year. That sounds like a pretty fast clip of more than a couple of months on average for the past 5 years, 6 years. So I do want to ask, in terms of like, I know last year you were doing a lot of deep dives into lighting. If you think about like your evolution as a world builder over the last like 5 to 6 years, what are some of like the milestones or turning points that you can point to say, okay, here's what you were looking at, here's this world, and you know, like kind of the development of your own artistic practice?
I would say the turning point, the first one was Moody. That was one that I'm most proud about when it comes to the like the complexity, where it was one of the first chill world where you can like literally click a button and you swap the environment outside, and then you swap day or night, the weathers. Like every scene have a different customizations, and I was very proud about it. It was my first spotlight world as well by VRChat. So in the technical sense, like I learned a lot of like triggers, how to do use the SDK and everything like that was the combination of that. And then well, I guess a few years later, Magic Haze happened. Right, and Magic Haze happened where it kind of opened the door to like Rye attraction style kind of world, and it's just more like, I would say, quote unquote, Hollywood like or Disneyland like type of world where it's big and complex and have a lot of moving parts together on a linear progression. So I would say Moody, Magic Haze, and then finally Complex 7, my latest piece, where it's less about the complexity of the technical process of like, you know, logic or trigger. It's more about like the technical aspect of optimizing, doing the lighting, making sure it performs well and just look the best it can be on the Unity engine, on that severely limited in a lot of way.
And I remember seeing Magic Heist either at Rain Dance or Venice. Where were you premiering that at?
It was Rain Dance.
Okay. Yeah, I think I was on the world jury that year, waiting for the build to come out. And so you have a lot of working on these different worlds that it seems like you're very driven by deadlines and trying to aim towards like its public release. So always pushing yourself to kind of get all the things ready for these public launches. And so, yeah, again, this year you have Project Lost Worlds, which is a project that I understand, as far as my understanding, is that you're showing a bit here, but it's going to be a little bit while until it's reached your threshold for the public launch.
Indeed. Deadline is a friend and enemy at the same time. It's a friend that is keeping me motivated and keep me on my feet so I don't slug off and then get distracted by another shiny thing that I want to do. But at the same time, it's my enemy because I want to take away my social life and a lot of my free time. I don't get to play video games. I don't get to like chat with friends as much as I would love to. So it's a double-edged knife, and it's still a constant battle to balance it so I don't go crazy, but at the same time I don't like get burned out and completely don't want to make world again. As far as Project Lost World goes, yes, the Venice version is extremely watered down. A lot of things was cut out. It's basically essentially an early alpha demo to what's to come, hopefully, ideally, summer next year, 2025.
Okay, so it's showing here during Venice Immersive, but going back into that private vault until it's ready to be released to the world sometime next year. So yeah, maybe you could just give me a little bit of the backstory. Where did Project Lost World start for you?
Way back in 2019. Actually, I wouldn't even call it further than that. One of the first world I wanted to make wasn't a cafe, but actually literally the Project Lost World itself. But I had no way of knowing how to do it. I just know I want to be in this world of like dinosaurs and bioluminescent plants and, you know, floating mountain, just like for the movie Avatar and the movie Jurassic Park, the thing that inspired me. But I just did not have the technical skill and even the artistic skill to do it on Unity. I tried it a couple of times, completely failed, deleted the project, forgot about it. Then about 2019, I did New Year Eve. They were selecting me as one of the people get to put a poster on the New Year Eve banner, and I put this thing like coming soon, and it was like a little imprint of the dinosaur foot on the thing and saying, this is coming soon, this is a dinosaur experience. But it never came because I did a few, well, I watched Back in the World, but like at the end of the day, it didn't feel like it was living up to the standard that I have even way back then. And I feel like I need more time. I need more experience, I need more time to learn Unity as the engine itself and even growing myself as an artist. And hopefully by the time I'm ready, and can execute it in the vision that I am having in my head.
Yeah, well, I know when you speak of the bioluminescence flowers and flora and fauna, reminds me of a piece that you had for, I think it was Rain Dance 2020, where it was from like Avatar-inspired world. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that world and how that came about.
Yeah, so it was a little teaser for Project Lost World at the time. But then Maria came to me and like, we want to feature you for the most impressive world. I was very confused. I was like, wait, why? Because this is a tiny little teaser. Like, well, when you want this on random, so I was very confused. But I was happy regardless to be a part of something cool. And that's when I discovered the whole, you know, like XR festival thing and Randance and all things like outside. Before that, I had no idea about any of this stuff. Like, so it wasn't a gateway to everything that happened now, even at Venice and, you know, with Project Lost World. So it's kind of like come all the way around. First, the very teaser for Project Lost World got into Rain Dance, and now I am featuring the demo version of Project Lost World at Venice, like years later. So it's quite a journey.
Yeah, and well, at some point along the way, you started to work for VRChat full-time as a world builder, you know, having around 100 worlds that you have, with 30 to 40 of them public and another 70 that are not public. But maybe you could talk about the process of starting to go work for VRChat and what are the type of stuff that you do there?
Yeah, getting hired by VRChat was a little unexpected, but I'm extremely happy to be here, very grateful, and I'm constantly humbled by the fact that they think I am skilled enough to be there. But I'm very dedicated to making sure that the expectations are living up to it. Through the day in the morning, I wake up at about 9 a.m., get myself ready, and check Slacks, see if I have any tasks, and then I go check in with my managers. And ideally, work from about 11 that all the way to like 6. I do take like half an hour lunch break, I think in the afternoon, sometimes, not always, sometimes. But then at 6 p.m., I sign off, and then I open my own Unity that I work on my stuff.
Nice. And so when did you start working for VRChat then?
September 2022.
Okay. So the tail end of the pandemic, after you had started to publish some of these worlds at these festivals that were being featured. And then, yeah, we talked last year and you were already working for VRChat for Complex 7. And now with the Lost Worlds, it's a really, I mean, I'll speak a little bit about my experience of the piece, because it's a really a vast world that you get entered into. Well, actually, maybe I'll let you kind of describe what you have now with the flow of the experience, because I know it may change at some point since it's not its final version. So I'll let you describe where you begin and then the different phases of this journey that you're taking on. It feels like this kind of like space travel agency, or in the future when people use the ability to go to another planet as kind of like a tourist safari.
Of course. Yeah. So the whole thing, even in the name, Project Lost World was meant to be accumulation of like my very childhood obsession with the stars and the universe. Like, I used to live in a place like you can look up and kind of see the star. And a lot of time I remember vividly when I was a little kid, I would sit down with my grandmothers and then look at the star and kind of wondering like, what are those blinking lights? And then I would look more and more into it. I start reading books, I start watching, you know, show related to that. And it's just a constant fascination for me. And growing up, I wanted to be an astronomer or even a potential astronaut. But unfortunately, I'm not academically gifted enough. So I turned away of artists, and this is my way of expressing that little childhood vision and wonders that I have. And in the name, the Project Lost World, is what it means is that when you're growing up and you're burdened with responsibility, the reality of getting money and getting food on the table, paying bills, taking care of your health and all of that stuff, you forget the world that you used to build in your head. And those wonders that you used to have as a little kid, the little dinosaur toys that you hold up and you imagine this whole, you know, landscape crawling with this amazing creature, or you imagine this one distant planet in the sky that you are maybe looking at right now, a full of life, like those little world that you build in your head lost in the unfortunate reality of adulthood. So Project Lost World is not literally also just like the world that it lost, but also in the sense that your childhood sometimes is lost. And this is a way to pay a little tribute and reminder of that lost childhood. So in the beginning of the Project Lost World, you hear the narrator, the kind of like the main character, essentially kind of like monologuing about, like, he used to look up in the sky and wondering about the star, which is pretty much like, it's just myself. It's a little bit of self-insert and what I used to think when I was a little kid. And just translating this another person and they narrating about this grandness of universe and wanting to explore. And after that, it's kind of flipped to this space station headquarters thing where, like, it's in the present time in this, where the story takes place, where he's much older now. And space travel is actually a normal thing. And the technology has been improved and advanced so far that people can, like, go to another stars. So you sit through this little introduction and little intro, like giving you the context of where you are, what are you doing, where are you going, and you're given this little ride to this grand launch pad where you can see the vehicle, and it kind of gives you a sense of like exciting of like what to come, and hopefully that kind of like get people like a little bit pump up. They are ready to embark on a grand adventure, and this vessel will take them to the stars. And there's this long sequence which I took a lot of liberty of listening to like hours of the NASA shuttle launch in real life, and I'm like, okay, how do I translate it into the script? At first it was a bit too long and I got great feedback from Ken, and then I cut it down, so it's a much more refined pace now. Hopefully I can even make it better as the full work came out. But yeah, you launch into space, you get a little bit of the overview effect when the Earth is kind of like roll down the window and the emotional music come in, the theme of the world. But give people, there's no narration, nothing, it's just a little music and a little, give people the time to think that hey, they're in space, this is like the journey are real. And then finally, you meet Astoria, like that's your home. It's the giant interstellar spaceship that can like go to another stars, and this is basically your home for the next couple of months as you travel to the next planet. Obviously, it's not going to be in literal couple of months, it's going to time skip. But Astoria is like a symbol of like humanity coming together, putting aside their difference, and building this like castle in the sky and taking people to places beyond human imagination. And there's this certain planet system called the Stellar System where they found one of the closest star system. It's fictional that there is life on these two moons rotating around a gas giant called Stratos. And your destination in 6 months is going to be that particular planet called Arios. And on Arios, it's kind of like Earth, but on like the Jurassic era, with a combination of like a lot of like fictional sign in it, and have floating mountain and bioluminescence plants, all of that. It's just a space travel wonder. There's no deep story. The closest to the deep story is that, right, the childhood wonder and everything like that. But at the end of the day, the simple joy of imagining and having an adventure and a journey going to another stars, and it's just a little escape from reality and go back to like where you used to be when you were a little kid.
Nice, beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, I think that recaps a lot of the highlights that I have for my trip. And I do think that the beginning of the Project Lost Worlds, especially the first couple of scenes, they're a little bit more cinematic in terms of like having narration, having some person who's got some explicit dialogue. A lot of times in your previous worlds, you've just kind of relied a lot more onto the environmental storytelling, or just have like little robots with little placards that you can add in later and read in. But I really think the start of this piece is really strong in terms of, you know, setting that context, and you're standing, you have a home where I guess this is the origin point when you talk about this narrator who's kind of an autobiographical representation of yourself, with this house that's on a lake with the pier that you walk out on, and then you
you have a disclaimer that this is not quite ready yet, but then we go into kind of launch sequence where you see this rocket ship going out in the distance. And so, yeah, there's a lot of moments in the piece where I was just filled with awe and wonder. And the type of environmental design, I think, is, you know, after seeing all the different experiences here at Venice Immersive, it's, you know, really world class. You know, like you said, you have a very high standard for the stuff that you're putting out there. So just a really impressive, like, world building and these vast scenes. But I feel like even though it's not explicit narrative, there's kind of a logic to the sequences that we're going through that have these cut scenes. And so it feels a lot more cinematic than the previous VRChat worlds, which were much more like site-specific environment that you're exploring around. And maybe there'll be some loading or whatnot, but it wasn't like these kind of more explicit cuts that you have. So I'm wondering if there was any inspirations that you took either from existing media, cinema, other film, immersive stories that you've seen over time that you wanted to have that a little bit more of a cinematic take in this piece.
Yeah, Project Lost World is very more film driven than most of the projects have gotten. Like Magic Haze was basically an attraction. Treasure Haze was like an adventure, Indiana Jones style interactive experience, but like even Complex 7, like a free roam place that you can do with making your own story and finding out what happened and do your speculation. But for Project Lost World itself, it's fairly film-driven, the way that it's presented and the way the scene is set up to give you a specific point of view and specific, like, you know, narration and delivering specific kind of, like, mental image. And a lot of that did come from various movie and pop culture and stuff that I love over the years. Interstellar literally was like the inspiration of like the beginning scene with the farmhouse, and then you move to like the space, big space station, and even the planet Avatar. So a lot of things, a accumulation of that inspiration. So there's no one particular one, but it's very film driven for sure.
Yeah, I know that when we were going through, you're giving me a private tour ahead of Venice Immersive, and you were mentioning Pacific Rim and Avatar, so maybe you could give a little bit about how some of these other films were playing in as well.
Yeah, mostly like the film like Interstellar, it's really hit home so hard about like the awe and wonders of like how small you are and the unknown of the universe and the stars, and even though you see it right there up in the sky all the time, anytime, you really don't understand what's really out there, and you don't know what's like. We are tiny, incomprehensibly tiny compared with what's out there. And then Avatar's like, it's a fantasy. It's a really good balance between like Interstellar, Avatar. One is purely fantasy. One is like fantasy, but also relies so much on the science to be onto it. So I feel there's such a good balance between those like inspiration that I have really loved over the years, to able to like, how do you get this work together? How do you express your love for all things cosmos, but also keep literally the magic and the fantasy in your head as a kid, or as somebody doesn't really understand, you know, the science behind it more, and hopefully it can have a story or experience that kind of relatable to more than just specific set of people.
So you're doing a VRChat world that is about space, which space is really big. And there's a problem with having VRChat worlds where if you get too far from the origin, you start to have floating point errors and things get really, really wonky. And so what kind of magic did you have to pull off in order to arrange all of this stuff in a way that you can stay each of these different places relatively close to the center, but also still have this incredibly vast world that you're creating? There seems to be some sort of magic that I don't quite understand what might be happening.
It's just a lot of janky way of organizing like layers and folders. Like literally the spawn that you spawn in the farmhouse. Later, that's literally where the planet Aerials is. But you don't see that because I set up a very specific way. Like every scene have a transition, and every transition have its own like cleaning and activating. It's like clean up and then activating. So it will clean up the previous scene and then make room for the next scene to come in. And then I keep reusing that space as much as I can to the point where like it may cause a problem. Like I don't get to do like occlusion cooling too much because the occlusion cooling is permanent. So that space is only for that particular set. So things like interior, like the space station on Astoria, this you occlusion cooling, I can't use that space anymore. That's only for that. But in the farmhouse, on aerials, or even the launch pads, a lot of things were reused. And a lot of smokes and mirror, like when you actually in the space shuttle and you start seeing things moving and stuff, that the space shuttle is actually just moving stationary. It's just rotating stationary, but it gives you that sense of motion. You're literally seeing your avatar and your friend's avatar hairs is starting going wonky, and then you see your nameplate, like, it's just rotating, but no, the thing is just rotating, like, stationarily, and you don't really feel that. So a lot of things is like movie magic, like you have to make believe somehow with the smoke and mirrors and the technical, and you hopefully you hide it enough that people don't notice it.
Yeah, I think that the scale of that, where you're going on to the spaceship that you're going to be on for 6 months, is like, it's one of the more vast VRChat world experiences that I've had, where you just have this sense of scale. Can you describe a little bit about like how big some of these objects are? Because it feels like it's pretty significantly large, and it's sometimes hard to tell when you're like flying into it. But I think you mentioned to me, look at that little window right there. That's about the size of an entire ship, which gave me a sense of like many orders of magnitude larger than what the ship was this other thing that I was looking at. But I haven't seen a lot of other VRChat worlds that are working at that level of scale. But maybe you could just give a bit of a sense of like what's the scales that you're working with here.
So, like you say, Astoria, the main ship where you stay, or not, if you put Astoria and then you put Complex 7, you need to have about 5 or 6 Complex 7 line up back to back to actually like get to the length of Astoria. Like, that's how big it is. And it's so big that by the time you reach Astoria on the shuttle, you already start getting floating point arrows because she is so far away, but she is so big. And once you are on Astoria and you look outside and you see Stratos. Stratos is almost, I would say, almost half the scale of an actual planet. Like, it's ginormous. And there was some shader magic needed to happen for you to able to see something that big and that far away. And if you actually took like a flying avatar and you try to like break out of the boundary and try to go to the planet, it would take you forever. It would take you forever, and you, by the time you reach it, you wouldn't, like, it wouldn't just cover your whole screen because it's so insanely big.
Why not just cheat something like that if it's so far away?
I wanted to. I might have to once the whole, you know, the full thing. But for now, I feel like it's such a big, like, major set piece that I don't want to undermine the possibility of it, you know, faking the scale a little bit. So yeah, there's movie magic, but at the same time, if I can do it in real scale, I will do it.
Okay, gotcha. And so it sounds like that because you're cleaning up stuff afterwards, that it's going to be very difficult for late joiners to come in, so people kind of have to join at the same time. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, hopefully the full version will allow late joining. But for now, unfortunately, due to the technical complexity of cleaning up, and it's master reliant. Everything is sync, right? So it's master reliant, which means late joining right now is not possible. I'm sure it will be possible if there's more time put into the tech and organizing how I am cleaning up thing, and organizing how, okay, maybe if you late join, you press this button, and it will like catch up you with like everyone else. Like, completely possible. It's just the matter of time putting into it, and I had a deadline. It's couldn't be done for now.
I know that there was a whole like Disney, like the Star Wars Starship Cruiser, that was like an immersive theater hotel where people would actually go and spend the night in a hotel, and then they would look out the windows, they'd see like space outside. And there's a lot of what being on this Astoria spaceship. I haven't been to the Disney's Starship Cruiser that's now shut down, but just like watching some videos and checking it out, it gave me this sense of actually going on this kind of interstellar adventure. And you know, you're in your living quarters, you're kind of walking through the hallways, you have like these tunnels that have bioluminescent flowers and flora and fauna that are reminding you of where you're about to go. You have these information placards that are giving information around the animals that are there, and then you have this big giant kind of holographic zoo that has these dinosaurs that are there that also have some information. And you were actually giving me a guided tour, and then you blipped out, and then I was left to myself to kind of look around, and I just kind of like really took my time to just look at everything because there was so much to look at, and like read all the different texts that you have. And there's a lot of stuff that I can imagine that there could be some tours that are just kind of like zipping through. But you have actually integrated a lot of these more environmental storytelling to kind of really imagine what it would be like to take this space tourism to this another planet. So yeah, I'd love to hear about your process of designing this cruise. It's like a interstellar cruise on this ship that you've created.
Of course, yeah. So this is great because like I binge watching so much cruise ship traveling documentary and reviewers, and they're like, okay, this is my experience, this is my hotel, what do I think about it? Oh, the food wasn't that great, and this is the lobby, what I think about the views and everything. I watched hours and hours on, even like months, like there was so much of it, and I took in a lot of mental pictures and information. Then I watched, like, I haven't been to Disneyland or Universal Studio in a long time, but I look a lot of like, you know, POV travel, and I took note of like how they present the, when you wait in line for like a particular ride, the line actually designed to like kind of onboarding you with like props and like story and screen with like maybe background, there's a little thing going on and kind of transport you from your reality to the story, to the world. And Astoria is, was that transport. Obviously there was the previous scene, but I want people to feel like they are in the destination, where in the place where they are travel, like they are arrive, and I want to feel every piece. This is why I put so much text and I put so much like details on a lot of things around people booking for tickets, tourists, food delivery robot. Everything makes sense because I want the set piece to every single thing you look at and you think of like, why is this thing here? And if you think for a moment, it makes sense. And it's something I noticed a lot of great attractions and a lot of things does. And I feel like it's something I want to replicate in a way that I feel would help deliver the experience. Hmm.
Yeah, did you think about actually going on a cruise?
I would love to, but I have not got a chance.
Okay, so you're doing a lot of research. I have been on one cruise in my life for my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, but I probably wouldn't have gone other than that sort of like family trip. But I did have my cruise adventure. And so, yeah, there is this moment of cruises where you have these little expeditions where you have an option to go do this or that. And so, you know, having these little advertisements in world that are telling you some of these different expeditions that you can go down into. And so in terms of the lore of this story, is this the main expedition that people can go on, or is this one of the side quests that are kind of one of many other different types of journeys that people could go on this cruise ship?
Lore-wise, if you look at a lot of the information more and even like the advertisement around Astoria, you can see they're actually advertising going to other planets, even within our solar system. Like going to Venus or going to, you know, Mercury and stuff, or even going to one of the other sister planet on Stratos, which is Aumelian, which is a water planet that have a lot of bioluminescent fish and life like underwater, but it's completely water. Lore-wise, yes, but for the particular world, it's all the areas, which is the main attraction.
Okay. Okay, so talk about your connection to dinosaurs.
Oh, I love them. Yeah, growing up, I have zoo books talking about dinosaurs. My mom, my dad got me like dinosaur toys. I watched Jurassic Park probably 7 or 8 times now. I love all things dinosaur because it's such a... It's no strange that a lot of kids have a fascination with dinosaurs, right? You have dinosaur toys and everything. It's kind of unbelievable that such life form used to exist before our times. And it's really sparked the imagination. And there's still a lot of things that we don't know about dinosaurs itself, literally, because even though they used to roam the planet, we don't know. We get things wrong. Like, dinosaurs maybe have letters, but now we find out that maybe they're full of feathers. Like, it's just really give a lot of room for interpretation and a lot of room for imagination. I think it played really well into, like, the alienness of it. Like, you can put a dinosaur in another planet, and it still makes sense. Yeah.
When I watched Joe Hunting's We Met in Virtual Reality, there's a scene where I think Dust Bunny and Toaster were going into like a Jeep where there was like a big Brontosaurus dinosaur in VR chat in this kind of like Jurassic Park like world. Had you seen any other dinosaur worlds in VR or VR chat before you made your Project Lost Worlds?
The world you're talking about is my world.
Oh, it's your world. Okay.
Yeah. It's my earlier prototype of Project Lost World. And I regularly used to give a private tour and I give links to friends and other people who are interested in trying the tour. As you can see, it used to be a Jeep. It used to be actually taking place in modern time. But then due to technical reasons, I found out like having a Jeep on bumpy surface and going off-roading probably not the most comfortable thing ever, especially if you have motion sickness, and also like the animation cost to it. And I feel like modern world doesn't really leave a lot of room for imagination, so I end up rewriting the story and doing it in the future where things are advanced and things were better, and it's more of a utopian timeline than what we're having to deal with right now.
Okay. Is that one of the 70 private worlds that you have in your vault?
Yes, and unfortunately that particular copy of Vertical Lost World is corrupted in my hard drive. I can no longer get it back. The only way it only exists from now is in the VHS cloud.
Okay, and so is that Brontosaurus that's in that movie of We Met in Virtual Reality in that clip that's from your world, is that the same Brontosaurus that's in this Project Lost World, or did you have to redo anything? Or?
Oh no, it's the same Brontosaurus. It's amazing. I pay a lot of money for that particular one, and it still served me so well after so many years. It's the main hero piece. Right, you know obviously the classic scene in Jurassic Park where they go in herds, like it's really show the scale and the sense of awe and wonder in many people, and the model itself is a phenomenal model. You can see all the little muscle jiggling and the skin just flapping as it's moving, like there's a sense of weight in it, and it's perfect. Money well spent.
Nice. Was that the first time that you had seen dinosaurs of that scale, was like building it yourself in your own world? Or was there any other references you had of other VR experiences or VR chat worlds that were playing with the dinosaurs? Or was the first time that you saw any of that from your own creations?
There is the other dinosaur world on VR chat, but they don't really have the particular scale or the quality when it comes to animation, understandably, because that stuff is either very expensive or very hard to come by. The only other dinosaur experience that I have is the old Oculus demo reel, where there's like a giant T-Rex in like a hallway of a museum or something, and it just starts coming at you, and then it's just cut to black. It's like a minute, and I think that's about it. Yeah.
Yeah, they showed that Oculus Connect 1 with the Crystal Cove demo, whatever the next demo that ended up maybe becoming the DK2 or whatever it was. I don't remember the exact, but it's definitely a demo scene that I remember seeing in 2014 in September. People were coming out of it, really being blown away at dinosaurs. Also, there's like Apple Vision Pro. They have Encounter Dinosaurs is a really high fidelity experience. Have you had a chance to see that one yet?
I saw people do it, but I don't have the Vision Pro, so I never got to try it. I would love to.
Okay, there are some Vision Pros that are here on site. You should see if you can get a demo of that. It's probably one of the more high fidelity, impressive experiences on Apple Vision Pro, at least, you know, at launch. It's really quite impressive. But you have a little bit more of an interaction with a big giant dinosaur at the fidelity of Apple Vision Pro. So, yeah, what was it like for you to, like, being in this world and running around the bioluminescence plants and the dinosaurs? And, you know, there's a little, like, the saying of, like, you can't get high with your own supply. But I think that there's, like, a little bit more limited in VR where you can actually, like, get into that state of awe and wonder. So, yeah, just wondering what it was like for you to kind of play in this world.
Of course. Doing things in the editors on a small monitor in your home, like, that's one thing. But, like, when I put on the headset, sometimes I surprise myself. Like, yeah, the brontosaurus is just walking out for the first time, or when I load into Pandora Night for the first time, I look around and I'm like, wow, the scale. Like, it translates so well in a VR headset. Like, it's just not the same thing at all. In the editor, you see this small little window and all the hierarchy in a project folder, and you put it together and you hope, you know, it will work. But once you put on the headset, yeah, I definitely have a lot of moments where I'm like, wow, this is working way better than I expected, or it's, you know, looking so much better. And then sometimes I want to relieve that experience by, you know, grabbing people, my friend, and then show it up to them, and they have their own reaction, and I get to relieve that experience. So yes, it's absolutely, yeah.
In the version that I saw, there was like a little robot guide that's there guiding you to where to go. But then also when you have a VR chat guide, they have the ability to kind of guide and direct people. And so wondering if you could elaborate on this design decision to like either have in-world things that help guide people along, or in this case, there's some docents that are a part of the festival. But this seems like the type of world where you could feasibly have people who like to live action role play and give people these types of tours. It feels like it's a type of experience that people could really start to live into.
Of course, yeah. With the current version of the world is built with Venice in mind, with the tour guide. Reggie, the robot, that's his name. I feel like it's so fitting to be on the tour, on a safari tour, and having your personal tour guide and really help you out with getting you to place you need to be and explaining you like what things are. I feel like it's really fit with the immersive, because a lot of people here are not super interactive and they really would love to like understand the context and think a little better. I feel like Reggie is a good balance between like kind of get you two things, but also at the same time giving you context and putting you deeper into the world. And then the two tour guide kind of like a supplement to that, and making sure that, you know, the technical, or make sure nothing goes wrong, things that outside of Reggie control, obviously, because he's the robot and the two tour guide are being there. But hopefully in the final version, there is a balance where if you just want to explore it by yourself, or having, you know, somebody want to, like you say, role play and something like that, you can turn off Reggie or you can mute him. And then for people who do, you know, enjoy tour guide or even have some hand holding, Reggie would be there to service you.
Great. So yeah, we're here back in Venice Immersive 2024. How's your trip been going so far?
I would say it's a bit more negative than last year, unfortunately, due to the weathers and the unfortunate location of my hotel. Getting from my hotel to Lido has been quite painful in literal sense. And for some reason, there has been probably twice as many people this year, so everything is packed. Everything is a bit crazy. I'm sure after I come back to my home, it's going to be quite a memorable experience in good and, you know, like bittersweet way. But at the same time, for now, it's quite crazy. So I am just getting through by the days, and hopefully by the time I come home, I still consider this a very memorable and enjoyable experience.
Nice. And have you been able to see any experiences?
I got to see Uncanny Valley by the Fairman Collective, and it was amazing. I love it a lot. It was very fun.
Nice. And I guess as we start to wrap up, I'd love to hear what you think the ultimate potential of virtual reality might be and what it might be able to enable.
I hate the word metaverse, and I hate the word, you know, like Oasis, like it's so overused at this point, but like, it's a space, you can do whatever you want, you can be anything you want, and it's such a profound, really like touching, that people can, you know, change their life, they can express themselves in the way that they want to do, or simply all they want to just log on and just chill in front of the mirrors, no judgment there. Like, there's a lot of potential. It's like the new internet, and I'm still optimistic that hopefully this continue, and the fact that the Biennale here having, you know, dedicated section to VR chat, where years ago is like a meme about a freaking little red guy on Guided Knuckles, and now we are showing artistic project, walking the red carpet. Like, we have a lot of work to do, we have a long way to go, but I'm happy where it had come so far.
Nice. And I know that last year at Venice Immersive, we had a chance to talk about a little bit of the preview of the creative economy that would launch a few months after that. And now it's still kind of being tested out, and there were some VR chat layoffs. And I think everybody in the XR industry is trying to look at this type of work and art that's showing at Venice Immersive and trying to figure out the real business models and how to really sustain it and distribute it and really make it viable. It's the same type of problems that the immersive storytellers are having in order to really figure out all that stuff. It's kind of also reflected in what VRChat's doing. So I'm wondering if you have any comments in terms of like what you see as some of the next steps of the types of creator economy or other things that are trying to like really have a new paradigm of a model that's going to really sustain a platform like VRChat. There's been a lot of conversations I've been having with folks at Raindance over the last couple of months, and just some folks, you know, kind of reflecting on all the different situations. So yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts that you want to share in terms of just kind of reflecting on where things are at and where you would like to see things go in the future.
Of course. Yeah. I am constantly remind myself, and I am very aware of the privileged position that I am in working at VRChat, doing my job, and doing, you know, VRChat world, and keep doing my passion, I'm able to pay for it and make this a dream job. And I know how hard and how unlikely that this is to thousands of insanely talented artists on our platform. And this is something I constantly want to push on. You know, like, yeah, you're making stuff. You can go to red carpet, you can get this feature, but at the end of the day, it's going to pay the bills and put food on the table. And it's a hard reality for a lot of people to really face when it comes to this kind of stuff. So creative economy, still a lot of work to do. Obviously, we're constantly going to try to improve it. And really, just the goal is empower artists, making the tool easier so that they can use and they can express themselves in whatever way, whenever they have a programming background or not, or, you know, let them able to earn some level of income and support so that they can keep doing what they love. And basically, it's just I want to able to see more people get to the point that I was privileged to been gotten to. I want to see more of that on the platform. Even on just VRChat as a whole. But on VRChat here, it's really, really a profound mission. Yeah, in the end of the day, we hope to keep continue doing what we can as a VRChat, as a platform, to keep providing a space for people to express themselves, to be with their friends, to connect. And personally, me as an artist, I hope that I can push VRChat in a way that help continue empowering other artists to able to financially support themselves and get their names and their work out there.
Did you happen to come across the company Emissive and the piece that they had this year, The Impressionist 1874? They also previously did Eternal Notre Dame. Had you heard of them at all or know of them?
I saw the name, but I have not gotten enough details to go into it.
Okay. Well, just to give a little bit of context is that they have a system where they can basically run 100 people per hour through this system, and they've had like 80,000 to like over 150,000 people over a number of months that are going to what is essentially like kind of like what you've done with this like VRChat world adventure. But imagine that, but you're going into like Notre Dame or the pyramids. You know, and it's basically a big giant space where people are walking through with like location-based entertainment headsets. And it's like, it's actually a business model where people are going and enjoying that type of experience. And, you know, when people do this type of world with the controllers, they're having like abstracted locomotion. But it seems like, as I was like thinking about that model, it seems like Project Lost Worlds is kind of like the perfect type of world that could make that transition where people would pay to actually walk through one-to-one scale and actually have the sense of going on this grand adventure that you're right. Taking people on. There are some branching stuff, but it's pretty much a linear path that I feel like it could be this process of really creating a flow or something. But obviously you're an employee of VRChat and it's, you know, on VRChat, but I will say after watching all the different content this year at Venice Immersive that the quality of world building that you have is like on that same scale that could very easily at some point make the leap into a location-based entertainment experience. And then also hopefully the type of experience that people would potentially be willing to pay for in the context of having some sort of ticketing or, you know, just having that type of thing that, yes, there are this many people that are seeing it in a physical installation, but VRChat has worlds that have hundreds of thousands or millions of people that are looking at it. So right. It can actually work at a different scale. But the economics of it are still kind of in this gift economy phase. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that. I don't know if you have any thoughts or have thought about your own work in the context of having people be able to actually walk through these worlds at one-to-one scale.
Yeah, obviously as an employee, I am not allowed to monetize. It would be a conflict of interest, but doesn't stop anybody else from doing something, you know, similar like that. And I can see that totally viable as a way to generate revenue whenever you're a person or a company, the demand you know, to try. Like we are here in Venice and we see so many people, but obviously to get here you need money, you need time, and a lot of people don't have that. And if you can go through like a experience in your comfort, your own home, and you can say the pyramid or you know location based or something like that, I feel like that would be quite attractive to a good amount of people.
Awesome. Well, Finns, do you have any other final thoughts or anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
This is pretty much similar to what I've said to other interview in the previous year. The immersive platform and honestly the community and the world around that is built on but for the people and by the people. The world are created by, sometimes you have corporate company, but most of the time, 99% of the time, it's by individual like me or like your friends or anybody else, and they're just expressing themselves, getting their art out there, and I want to encourage people to keep on creating, keep on building. It's a collective effort to build this, you know, space that we all share. And it's a wonderful thing to see that, you know, so many talented people able to share their vision, and I hope this continue for a long time.
Awesome. Well, Fenz, thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast to talk a little bit more about Project Lost Worlds and a little bit of a sneak peek that we're seeing here at Venice Immersive. I feel very lucky to be able to get a little bit of a look at where things might be going here in the future. And I actually think it's already fully formed enough to, like, I feel like it's, you know, it was one of my top 10 experiences that I saw this year, just because I feel like there is so much quality master world building that you have. And yeah, it's just a really beautiful piece and very much a high attention to detail in all your pieces, and especially this work as well. So very much looking forward to whenever it gets to the final phase of being ready for launch. But thanks again for taking the time to help share a little bit more about your story and the process of making Project Lost World. So thank you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for the opportunity, and I hope to see you again soon.
Thanks again for listening to these episodes from Venice Immersive 2024. And I am a crowdfunded independent journalist, and so if you enjoy this coverage and find it valuable, then please do consider joining my Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.